I'm able to get you interested in the topic I'm going to speak about today, which is psychotic disorders and their development. And when I first entered this field in graduate school, really, I did my dissertation on schizophrenia, but especially on my postdoc when I was really submerged in the field, it was so much simpler. Basically, two themes of this talk today. One is that everything is more complicated than we ever thought it was. And second, that our psychosocial environments get into our heads in very strange ways. And I'm going to show you some data that suggests that the trajectory of development during adolescence is influenced by our experiences and the biological processes that are triggered by those experiences. So I'll give a background first on just the general state of our knowledge of psychotic disorders, their etiology. Then I'm going to talk about a collaborative project we have ongoing. It's a study that involves 8 sites. Emory is one, Harvard, Yale, UCLA, UNC. And one of the blessings of my career has been the fact that I am now collaborating on a large national project with people that I have known for 25 years minimum, all of them, which not only ages me, so it was stupid to say, but also gives you some idea of the depth of our collaboration. I'm going to be talking about some preliminary findings from this consortium. So a lot of things that have yet to be published, and our future goals and the implications for preventive intervention. So first, what do we assume? Well, psychotic disorders, especially schizophrenia, so when I say psychotic disorders, I'm talking about mood disorders with psychotic features, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder. We tend to use the term psychotic disorders now because all the data that are accumulating on genetic factors and other factors clearly indicate that the diagnostic boundaries we have in the DSM are not correct, that they are not dividing nature at its joints or whatever the saying is, that in fact we are just beginning to understand the determinants and they overlap dramatically among psychiatric disorders, especially the more severe ones like psychotic disorders. About 1 to 2% of the population suffers from a psychotic disorder at some point in their life, and typically the onset is in young adulthood. Risk factors, including genetic and prenatal factors, appear to confer vulnerability. So it appears that vulnerability to these disorders is congenital in that it's present at birth. And these vulnerability factors, again, are nonspecific. They cut across psychotic disorders. Now, the focus of our research currently is something called the prodrome to psychosis. And the prodrome is typically manifested in mid-adolescence, the first onset of the prodrome. The prodrome is a period of decline in functioning that precedes the onset of psychosis. It can last for as brief a period as a few months to years, 2 to 3 years. And our research approach is intended to capitalize on that period because we think that some of the critical mechanisms producing psychotic disorders are arising during that prodromal, typically adolescent period, and that our opportunities for preventive intervention are going to be maximized if we focus on that developmental stage. So in this figure, what you see is a kind of general conceptualization of the prodrome. So in the life history of an individual who develops psychosis, there's typically a decline in behavioral adaptation, begins around the age of 15, and then impairs development through the rest of the life course. When it comes to the psychotic symptoms, they tend to emerge during that mid-adolescent period, early adulthood, and then psychosis tends to be episodic. So psychotic episodes come and go. People get admitted to the hospital, get released, and so on, if they're lucky. Sometimes they get admitted to jail and then get released. So our focus is to cut that process short and to intervene ultimately in a way that interrupts that decline in functioning, brings the individual back up into the normal range, and also interrupts the onset of psychotic symptoms so that they never elevate to a level of severity where the individual receives a diagnosis of psychosis. And we consider that very important because there's a lot of evidence now that the longer people are experiencing psychotic episodes, the worse the prognosis. So it appears to be toxic to the brain. I suspect a lot of you here have seen movies like The Soloist, Beautiful Mind. Those are films depicting people with schizophrenia. The Soloist in particular, very, very accurate description. I had the honor of meeting and serving on a panel with that man, Nathaniel. He is not a typical patient. He's not a typical person in that he was a musical genius whose life was derailed by schizophrenia, just like John Nash in A Beautiful Mind. But like a typical patient with schizophrenia, Nathaniel showed that up and down episodic kind of pattern. So psychotic disorders are very debilitating and often chronic. Yes, sir?
Could I ask a quick question?
Certainly.
On that previous slide?
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing in the pre-morbid period that would allow you to identify those in the syndrome that are going to go off and start your preemptive intervention earlier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. Actually, we did some research, started a couple of decades ago, shortly after I left Cornell, where we used childhood home movies to look at the early infant development of individuals who became schizophrenic, developed a diagnosis of schizophrenia in their 20s predominantly. And we did see subtle signs of affective abnormality, more negative than positive affect. They were distinguishable statistically from their healthy siblings. We also saw motor abnormalities. But none of that, although it suggested to us that their vulnerability was there early on, none of it was outside of the normal range of how infants vary. So it was a matter of the distribution for motor development being slightly shifted downward, but with lots of overlap with the normal distribution. So, yes, we have ruled out, at this point at least, childhood, pre-adolescent years as likely years for preventive intervention, because for the most part, it's within the normal range.
So in terms of exophenotypes, but I was thinking maybe endophenotypes would be...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We know much less about that, in large part because it's so difficult to do that kind of intensive longitudinal study beginning in infancy, since only 1-2% of the population will develop the disorder. So this is going to be a quickie overview of what we know right now about psychotic disorders, and then I'm going to get into some more details about our work and recent developments. Prenatal insults are linked with risk for psychotic disorders. Toxemia, any kind of prenatal complication, including maternal viral infection and including maternal stress exposure. There are inherited genetic factors involved. Risk for psychotic disorders tends to run in families, but much, much less than we had previously assumed. New developments, genetic mutations, Just a couple of weeks ago, another important paper published in Nature showing an incredibly elevated rate of de novo or spontaneous genetic mutations in individuals with autism and schizophrenia. These are non-inherited. They are de novo, arising early in the development of the zygote. They're playing a much bigger role than we had ever assumed, and we had confused them for inherited genetic influences in some of our twin studies, because monozygotic twins are more likely to share spontaneous mutations than our dizygotic twins. So that was inflating our heritability estimates. Our heritability data make more sense now that we know about these mutations. They also make more sense now that we know about epigenetics. Epigenetics are changes in the expression of genes that arise as a function of environmental factors, both endogenous environmental factors like hormones and external factors like stressors. Major new developments in the field of epigenetics. So we assume then, based on our data, that those factors are all operating to produce some kind of congenital vulnerability. And it says here, I know this is not very readable in this slide, it says DA frontal striatal circuitry, that refers to dopamine circuitry. And that's just the best guess right now that researchers have of what's unusual about the subcortical structures in risk for psychosis. I won't go into detail on that, and needless to say, there's plenty of evidence to support it. That's why it's been hypothesized. But it's clearly not sufficient, because the majority of people who are going to develop a disorder like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with psychosis have relatively normal childhoods. The vulnerability is latent. It's not manifested till adolescence. And that's why we think adolescent neuromaturation is very important. And of course, what happens then is there's an activation of the HPA and HPG axes. In other words, gonadal hormones, HPA axis, hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, stress system in the brain. Cortisol is increasing during the course of adolescence. It seems to be a normative process. And there's evidence now that these hormones, exciting new studies showing how these hormones in animal research can change the expression of genes, which in turn alter brain development, synapses, gray, white matter. And many of these processes are kind of circular, so that brain changes are influencing hormonal changes and vice versa. One of the most interesting developments, I think, in the field of developmental neuroscience is that the changes in the brain that occur during the course of adolescence are partially regressive. In other words, it's just not a matter of brain volume increasing, brain connectivity increasing. There is actually loss of brain tissue during the course of adolescence. So many, many studies now have shown that there's a decline in gray matter in normal, healthy adolescents. And many of you who have already reared adolescents don't find this as any surprise whatsoever. But in fact, presumably, it's a healthy process, and what it's reflecting is changes in synapses, or what some people refer to as synaptic pruning, other kinds of reorganization that actually makes the brain more efficient. So at the same time adolescents are showing a decline in gray matter volume, they're also showing an increase in cognitive ability, at least certain cognitive abilities. Now, that's the normative process, but we think that what we have in psychopathology, especially mental illnesses like psychosis, is a superimposed pathological process. And for those of you who can't read it, that says stress at the top. And we know that stress can activate biological stress systems in the brain, the HPA axis in particular, and sometimes to a level that's dysfunctional, a hyperactivity of those systems, And that in turn can trigger a host of processes, neurotransmitter abnormalities. It says up there, dopamine hyperactivity, glutamatergic neurotoxicity. I'm not going to get into details about those processes. But it's important to understand that when we think about the stressful experiences that occur during the course of adolescence, we're talking about psychosocial events that are triggering tremendous changes in the brain's biochemistry and structure. And that we undoubtedly have to look closely at those if we want to understand why it is that so many mental illnesses are having their onset, especially the prodromal phase during that period. So the rest of this basically says that we've got a circular process going on where the release of stress hormones, HPA hyperactivity, is triggering the expression of genes, triggering brain degenerative processes, impairing cognitive and role function, contributing further to stress, and it's becoming a kind of vicious cycle. And if it continues, can lead to psychosis. So that's our sort of theoretical model, and it's built on a lot of accumulating evidence. So let me move forward to where we are now and what we know from some of our recent findings. Whoops, let me just stop there. I'm not going to go into detail. I have a hunch that many of you, most of you here, know that cortisol is a major stress hormone, and its release is governed by the HPA axis. So there's a cascade of hormonal effects that follow stress exposure. And this is just one example of many studies showing that that is a system that's hyperactivated in adolescence, especially, interestingly enough, in response to social stressors. So this shows the results from a study comparing cortisol release in response to performance stress and peer rejection stress in adolescents and younger children. And what you can see is the dashed line adolescents, much higher level of cortisol release. In fact, they have slightly elevated cortisol, elevated baseline cortisol, even prior to the onset of the stressor. And in our studies, I think I have a figure to show you, we find that the increase in cortisol, baseline and stress-induced, begins about 13 years of age and extends into early adulthood, into the early 20s. There's also an increase in receptors for stress hormones in the brain. So again, not going into detail, but this is work from some colleagues looking at the expression of what are called glucocorticoid, in other words, cortisol receptors. And this is a postmortem study, as you can imagine, if they're in the brain counting receptors. And as you can see, adolescents, big increase in the receptors for stress hormones. So at the level of receptors, at the level of stress hormones, we're seeing an increase. Now, we're interested in hormones for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is because of what I alluded to earlier, epigenetic processes, the way genes get turned on and turned off by environmental events and also developmental processes. So epigenetics is the study of changes in gene expression that are independent of the DNA. So we're not talking about DNA, we're talking about RNA and changes in protein production from genes that influence the impact that that gene can have on our behavior, our development. So changes that are influencing the biobehavioral phenotype. I mentioned previously something about maternal stress increasing the risk for mental illness in offspring. It's assumed that that's mediated by an epigenetic process. In other words, that the mother's stress hormones are altering patterns of gene expression in the fetus, and those changes are influencing the developmental trajectory. Sure.
Mm-hmm. So does that control for the higher incidence of psychosis in the mother? So obviously if the mother is more likely to have mm-hmm. problems of whatever kind and you're not controlling
that's
that,
right.
It would be confounded, right?
Absolutely.
But I assume it's controlling.
Yeah, the studies that have looked at the impact of maternal stress have primarily focused on natural disasters, experiments in nature. So they can compare women who were exposed when they were pregnant, for example, to an earthquake in China, to war. There's one study of women whose husbands went into the military, and they compared the offspring of the women whose husbands died to those whose husbands came back. And they found a higher rate of mental illness in the offspring of the moms who lost their husbands while they were pregnant. So a variety of controls to address that potential confound. So as I said, epigenetic changes can occur throughout the lifespan. It's assumed that they're most common prenatally because there's so much development going on. And now many people believe that they're occurring more often, another critical period, during adolescence. Every time I hear somebody say, oh, don't worry about your kid going out, you've done all you can now, they've got the values they're going to have or they don't, you know, don't worry, I think, I'm not so sure about that. I think there's still some changes going on in that brain. I want to use an illustration from a paper that I think is a very helpful one thinking about epigenetics. This is a paper that appeared in Nature and basically talks about how this new field of epigenetics, where we can study changes in gene expression, has revolutionized the way we think about human illness, disease, and health and development. And I'm not sure how clear this is to everybody, but what the investigator is trying to show here in this review article is that there are epigenetic profiles or patterns. This is different from mutations now. So these are epigenetic profiles of gene expression that are imprinted, are determined prenatally, and partially make monozygotic twins more similar than dizygotic twins for reasons independent of anything they inherited. So epigenetic programs that are set, established based on maternal stress, nutritional factors during pregnancy, and so on. It turns out that when researchers compare monozygotic twins where one member of the twin pair has a schizophrenic disorder and the other does not, there are differences in their epigenetic profiles. DNA identical, epigenetic profiles different, presumably due to environmental factors. Okay, I'm going to skip over a few things here to make sure I get to some of our findings. Evidence that epigenetic changes are occurring in humans. As you can imagine, a lot of the new advances in molecular genetics are very difficult to establish in humans. It's so easy with animals. So many of these important findings about the impact of stress, for example, came from animal research. Steve mentioned earlier McEwen, major neuroscientist. He's done amazing studies showing how the environmental context in which, for example, rodents exist during pregnancy influence the epigenetic profiles of their offspring, which in turn influence their offspring's development and behavior. Now, we cannot very easily in humans do those kinds of manipulations. Thank goodness we would never think of systematically exposing human beings to stressors in a way that could derail the rest of their development. So a lot of what we know about this in the case of humans is based on experiments in nature, like the earthquakes, for example, and also postmortem studies. So these are findings from a postmortem study of the brains of individuals over time. So it's cross-sectional in nature. And what the researchers are trying to get at here is whether some of the genes that have been implicated in psychotic disorders like schizophrenia are changing in their patterns of expression over time. And in fact, they are finding that. So consistent with some findings that have been reported for other species, rodents, non-human primates, we're seeing evidence that the human brain is also showing developmental changes in the pattern of the expression of genes and epigenetics. Now, presumably, those effects are partially influenced by changes that are endogenous. In other words, changes like the onset of puberty. Hormones, it turns out, just play a big, big role in epigenetics. Stress hormones and gonadal hormones like testosterone, estrogen. And they do it in two ways. One way is activational. So activational effects are kind of transient effects of hormones, the kinds of effects that occur, for example, in cyclic changes in women, hormonal changes that influence perhaps memory, mood, and so on. Typically short-term, and it's assumed that they're due to the triggering of receptors for hormones on the surface of nerve cells. But then there are other effects that are called organizational effects, and those are actually changes in the structure of the brain. People used to think, researchers in the field of developmental neurobiology, that most of these effects occurred prenatally, so that hormones, circulating hormones, were influencing the structure of the brain in the fetus in a way that determined, for example, sex type behaviors, proclivities, various characteristics of the brain that influence developmental trajectories and behavior patterns. But we now know that some of those same effects are occurring during the teenage years. Okay, there we go. This is just a figure illustrating some of the various genes. As some of you will know who study genetics, they come up with the most amazing genes. There's a gene called Frizzle, another one called Trash, another one called Disco. I'm not sure how that develops, but these are all genes that are actually known to be sensitive to stress hormones or glucocorticoids. In other words, stress hormones can turn them on or turn them off. And this was published in 2008. The list of genes that are under the control of hormones is even greater now than was known then. So, summary then. Hormone secretion due to the HPA and HPG axis increasing dramatically in adolescence. That in turn is influencing the expression of genes that govern brain development. Studies that have been conducted, for example, on youngsters who have abnormalities in pubertal development and have low levels of testosterone or estrogen show they have abnormal brain development. And when they get those levels into normal boundaries, brain development can change. So that's the normal adolescent developmental trajectory. And we think that that is probably going awry in risk for psychosis. So I'm going to be talking now about some of our research findings. We have this study called the North American Prodrome Longitudinal Study. NAPLES is the acronym. It's a multi-site study. How it got this name, we are not sure. Just remember leaving a meeting at NIMH one time after a dinner and a bottle of wine and somebody saying, how about this? And we all said, sounds good because it spells NAPLES. And so that's what it ended up being. And we have as I said, 8 sites and 8 PI collaborators. So originally, we pooled data. We were all conducting research, longitudinal research, on the etiology of psychosis, and we pooled our data into one large data set through the support of NIMH. And we formed our consortium and began to do research. And in addition, we began, as we were analyzing our pooled data, to develop an application for a multi-site project to be funded by the NIMH. And we wanted to do a study where we had uniform measurements of brain development, hormonal development, and behavior. So our basic assumptions meant, as I mentioned earlier, that vulnerability is present at birth and that it's triggered by neuromaturational processes in the environment, and that the most likely stage for preventive intervention is going to be adolescence during that prodromal period. I think I have a little defect in the code for this, so I'm getting a kind of backward presentation. This is a scale, the scale of prodromal syndromes that we use to identify individuals who are at risk for psychotic disorders. There's an extensive body of research on this particular scale. It was developed at Yale. It helps us to identify individuals at risk with a level of accuracy much, much better than anything else. So for individuals who are showing the pattern of symptoms that we have statistically identified as being most associated with psychosis, the risk rate is about 30 to 40%. So we identify youngsters using this scale, and within 2 to 3 years, about 30 to 40% of those who meet these prodromal criteria develop a psychotic disorder. Much better prediction rate than we would have if we use something like family history of disorder. So this is a list of some of the symptoms: unusual thoughts, suspiciousness, grandiosity, and then what we call negative symptoms, social isolation, withdrawal, decreased emotion in experience and expression. But subclinical versions, so these are not individuals who are yet having hallucinations and delusions. These are individuals who are showing more subtle versions of those symptoms. So let me show you an excerpt from an interview to illustrate that. Yes, sir.
Those features, do they tend to be distributed on a continuum, so that what you're seeing is the tail of the distribution, or is this a categorical thing where it's like a bimodal distribution?
You know, that is a great question. And I think the answer is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that there is a distribution of, for example, unusual perceptual experiences or anomalies. But when you get to a certain threshold where there's a level of confidence expressed, there's a kind of discontinuity. So there seems to be an upper end to the severity distribution that identifies a taxonomy that's a little bit separate. But that's still a matter of dispute and discussion. But here's what it sounds like. I was going to show a film excerpt, but something happened to my video. So this might be a good substitute. So a 14-year-old male, the interviewer says, "Do you ever hear or see things that others do not?" And the child says, "Sometimes I hear noises at night that scare me." "What do you hear?" "Just noises, but they sound like voices. Then I close my eyes until I get the courage to open them, and I find out it's a fan or some other available prop." That was his exact wording. "So it isn't real?" "It is a real sound, but it's not a ghost." Then he spontaneously says, "My brother thinks I'm crazy." And he starts to laugh, and he turns and looks at the wall. "Why does he think you're crazy?" "Because I'm not like him. He thinks I'm mentally ill. I don't have any friends." So the critical thing here is that this young man says that he knows it's not real. And that's a distinction from meeting diagnostic criteria for psychotic disorder, because in psychosis, people believe it is real. So in A Beautiful Mind, John Nash went and left messages for the CIA because he believed he was really being followed by the CIA. He didn't say, it must just be my imagination. I'm not going to go leave responses for the CIA. This isn't happening. He believed it was really happening. So conviction is a critical threshold or cutoff point in psychotic symptoms. So we're dealing with people who are prior to that level of conviction in their perceptual experiences. So this figure shows one of our first studies where we looked at individuals identified as being prodromal using that scale, followed them over time, and as you can see in this survival curve, significantly larger proportion of the young people who met our criteria developed a psychotic disorder. And if we continued beyond that time period, you'd see an increasing number. So we clearly have an instrument that's helpful in identifying risk factors. Yes, ma'am.
Did you have any IQ information on these children at all?
You know, we do measure that. And in fact, right now, we have a cutoff point. So in our current study, criteria are that you have to have an IQ of at least 70.
At the validity of the kind of response that young boy gave, and a pretty clever 14-year-old.
Yes.
Say, of course they know they're not real.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something else going on if his brother perceives him as having a mental disorder. So if this kid is pretty bright, and he knows he's going to sound crazy if he says those are real. Well, I just wonder if you're factoring
that kind of ability. You're raising a really interesting question about the impact of cognitive ability on the expression of symptoms. And we don't know the answers to that, but Florence, that is such an interesting question, and we're collecting data on that longitudinally now to see how cognitive developmental factors are influencing the trajectory. But I can tell you that that young boy, within 3 years of that interview, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and had one inpatient psychiatric hospitalization and was on antipsychotics. And he no longer mistook a fan for something. He had conviction that people were coming into his room at night. If you questioned him about it, he argued back, no, it's not my imagination, this is happening. So he crossed that threshold.
One question about the, is it possible, I mean, is it actual that you have zero controls that show psychosis? So
that's right. Yeah, zero controls in this study. This is about 500 participants, and the mean age at baseline was about 17 years. And during that period of time, none of the control subjects showed a disorder. Now, that doesn't mean they won't eventually, in subsequent studies, we have had some controls who were diagnosed with psychosis. Okay, so one of the things we looked at in our first study, our first Naples project, was how cortisol was changing over time in these youngsters. Now, these data are from a group of high-risk or prodromal teenagers. These are the data for cortisol for those who did not convert to psychosis and those who converted to psychosis. Baseline cortisol, follow-up, 6 months, 12 months, area under the curve, for those three. What you can see is that there's a much lower level of cortisol secretion at every time point in the non-converted compared to the converted children. So even prior to the onset of psychosis, conversion to psychosis, we were seeing a developmental trajectory of higher baseline cortisol in those who developed psychosis. What you can also see here is that normative increase over time, even in those who did not develop a psychotic disorder, and that's that adolescent increase in HPA activity. So let me turn now to our current study, and these are the measures we're using. There is no way we could do this study without it being a collaborative project. We're looking at psychological functions, brain development, EEG, MRI. We're genotyping, looking at RNA to assess gene expression changes over time. We're looking at hormonal changes, adrenal and gonadal, neuropsychological assessment, and life event, and daily stressors. So our design is baseline 6 months. We're doing repeated assessments over time using all these measures to try to get at not only how to better predict who might develop psychosis, but also to understand the underlying mechanisms. Okay, so here's some preliminary data. None of this is yet in the literature. Age on the horizontal axis, and these are the reports for the prodromal, those who meet our risk criteria, and the control subjects, their reports of mean daily stress. Clearly, the kids who are showing our risk profile are reporting much more daily stress. And that's the case across the age span that we're addressing here, but with a clear increase through adolescence. So both the at-risk and the control kids are reporting more stress as they head through adolescence. So adolescence is a stressful period, at least by self-report. These are life event stressors, same kind of pattern. Now this you would kind of expect because life events build up. So we're measuring here previous stressful life events. And those, too, are showing an increase, at least by self-report, through the course of adolescence, but more pronounced in the kids at risk for psychosis. And this is cortisol. And what we're seeing, again, that developmental increase, but with the at-risk kids, the green bars, showing higher levels at every age.
Mm-hmm. Do you think some of this is because these kids are not reading social cues and getting themselves into situations that are dangerous or complicated or distressing?
I think that is part of it. I think that because of their symptoms, they are getting themselves into more stress-inducing situations. So it's a kind of stress induction phenomena due to the phenotype. But in addition, they seem to be more responsive to stressors. So some recent experimental studies exposing at-risk and control kids to the same stressor are showing a greater stress response in the at-risk kids. So these are data comparing the healthy and at-risk subjects, again, at-risk with the green line from our most recent study, again, showing higher cortisol levels.
Mm-hmm. Question, these are at-rest levels or are they stimulated?
These are baseline levels. Our IRBs would not allow us, given the evidence that stress is linked with risk for mental disorder, will not allow us to intentionally subject them to a stress paradigm.
Not a math
test
or
Well, you know, we used to use that. We used to use the Trier test, but we're trying to avoid that now because we don't want to get into trouble with the IRB. And we feel like we're able to detect differences as is. So some other labs in Europe studying this population are using structured stress exposure paradigms. But we decided to play it safe.
You must have changed IRB too.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Uh-huh, in major change. Okay.
Can you just say how these cortisol levels correspond to when they were showing psychotic symptoms?
Mm-hmm. So this is before. This is similar to the figure that was on when you raised your question. This is a more pronounced difference. This is only the high-risk group, the prodromals, and we're comparing here those who converted to a psychotic disorder within 2 years and those who did not. So these are their baseline levels of salivary cortisol. So having elevated cortisol seems to predict to converting to psychosis. And that makes sense for a variety of reasons. Now, one of the things some previous studies had shown is that there are changes in the volume of certain brain structures during the prodrome and the early stages of psychosis. So this is from the first study that was published addressing that by a Japanese group, showing that on average there's a greater decline in the volume of many brain regions in teenagers who go on to develop psychosis. So needless to say, we were very interested in studying brain development in our subjects. And these are some of our preliminary findings. So when we compare the volume of gray matter, cortical gray matter, cross-sectionally in this case, I'll show it to you longitudinally in the next slide, we're comparing here cases, that is individuals at risk, and the highlighted areas are regions where they're showing more of an age-related decline in volume. These are healthy controls. In this case, the comparison is to illustrate the areas where the healthy control adolescents show more of a decline in gray matter volume than the at-risk kids. Basic summary, the at-risk kids are showing much more dramatic age-related decline in gray matter volume. So it's as if a normal adolescent process is being exaggerated. Now, this is actually longitudinal data. Comparing those who develop psychosis to our healthy controls, big differences in gray matter volume change over time. Comparing those who, areas of the brain where those who converted to psychosis show less of a decline than controls, and the answer is virtually no areas. So in every case where we compare the converters, those who develop psychosis, to the healthy controls, are the at-risk kids who don't develop psychosis, we're seeing this greater decline in gray matter. And it's in the prefrontal cortex, it's throughout the cortex actually, but it appears from some of our preliminary data that the prefrontal cortex is especially important in terms of predicting function. So what's causing this? So here we see our healthy controls, again, another view of this developmental change, age, gray matter volume, normal process. All of us, when we were teenagers, were losing our minds, just like this. The at-risk, the prodromals, same pattern, but more pronounced. Whoops. Okay, that's prefrontal gray matter, so. Prefrontal cortex, same pattern. Stressful life events. These are results of a regression analysis where we put in both stressful life events as they report them and cortisol levels at baseline as measured multiple times. That's our procedure. Significant relationship between stressful life events and the rate of gray matter decline. So the more stressful life events, these at-risk youngsters have been exposed to, the more rapid the decline in their gray matter volume. Cortisol level, same kind of pattern. And the interesting thing to me, these are findings from analyses I just did last week. These are significant independent predictors. In other words, in the regression equation at the same time. So there is a predictive relationship between life stress and gray matter volume that's independent of cortisol level when they enter the study and gray matter volume. What that suggests to us is that there's both a cumulative effect of life stress and also an effect that's based on their circumstances when they entered our study as indexed by cortisol levels. So we are going, I'm going to skip over some of these things and just say that at this point we're pleased that we're detecting some developmental processes that are linked with biological processes that are linked with conversion to psychosis. We think we're getting a handle on some of the underlying mechanisms, and we're very eager in our next set of analyses. We're just beginning to look at the gene expression data to see if we can track the pattern of changes in gene expression. Now, it's peripheral. It won't be postmortem. We're looking at blood. But the changes in gene expression that might be linked up with these changes in gray matter volume that are perhaps overshooting during adolescence and increasing risk for psychosis. So that's the story of where we are right now, and I hope that within the next year, there's going to be many more findings. Thank you very much for your attention.